Good morning. You tuned into the International Connection for another Sunday. We're continuing on with our series on mind control, and this week we're going to be featuring a presentation done by Claudia Mullen at the recent Believe the Children conference in Chicago of April of 97, where she describes her growing up in an atmosphere of an abusive mother and her mother involving her in mind control experiments at Tulane University in New Orleans. Claudia Mullen also gave testimony about mind control to the Presidential Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments in March of 95. You'll hear her refer to multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder, which is the new term for multiple personality. And we have heard in previous shows how severe trauma can cause dissociation or multiple personalities in some children, and how multiple personalities has been used by the CIA to create programmed agents for government intelligence and military. The second half of this hour, we'll be starting an interview I conducted with Claudia, and that will continue on for the next 2 weeks after. You're listening to 88.1 CKLN.
Thank you for coming this afternoon. And you'll pardon me if I'm a little bit nervous, but I see some friendly faces out there, so that makes it better. Let's see if I can figure out how to turn this on. Can you all read that? It says, it is 1953. How much is a child's mind worth? If you'll picture this with me, this little girl, she's not quite 3 years old. She's been adopted when she was 2.5 years old, lived in an orphanage until then, from the time she was born. They called it infant asylums back then. She was adopted by this prominent, wealthy family in New Orleans. And she's been preparing for this picture for about 3 weeks now. And the way she prepared is her monster mom, which she calls the mommy that adopted her, she calls her the monster mom. Monster mom has been letting her go outside every day and play in the sandbox completely naked so that she gets, quote, brown as a berry all over, and her little toe head gets even blonder. So she's not really sure why this is so important, but she's going to get her picture taken. So the day has come. Monster mom puts on her little sundress and her tennis shoes, puts on her charm bracelet that her godmother gave her, and she goes outside in the backyard, and there's a man out there with a camera, strange man. So the little girl's like very, very nervous, because just like me, because see, everything in her life has to be completely controlled. Everything has to happen according to how her mother wants it to be. Otherwise, there's serious repercussions. She gets hurt real bad. Plus, Monster Mom likes to do kind of yucky things to her that she doesn't really understand why, but it's all part of life. So, actually, by the time she was about 20 months old, when she lived in the orphan asylum, she had started to have imaginary friends that she talked to, and they comforted her. And so now she has a few more imaginary friends who sometimes come out when mommy does the yucky things, or when she gets punished for spilling her milk or not washing her hands all the way. Anyhow, so mommy says, now you be a good girl and don't make mommy mad, because you know what'll happen. Well, what'll happen is you go back to the orphan asylum. She's always being told that's what's going to happen if she's bad. Mommy can always hold that over her head, and she does until she's a teenager when her mommy dies. But anyhow, so she gets ready for the picture, and already she's completely controlled. And she stands there, and she gets ready to smile, because mommy says, smile for the man. And she tilts her head like she always does when she smiles. And all of a sudden, the little strap on the sundress falls down. Ooh. And she doesn't know what she's going to do, because this means Monster Mom's going to get really, really mad, because she didn't plan on this happening. But instead, something really strange happens. Mommy comes up, kind of looks at her, kneels down, and goes, "Perfect," and pulls the strap down a little bit more. "Just like that," she says. "Okay, take a picture. Smile." And so she smiles. And turns out, the reason Mommy wanted to take the picture was to send it to all her society friends that she wants to be in with, because she's what you would call a social climber. And the little girl doesn't realize until years later what Mommy was really doing. She was advertising her daughter that she had adopted, this wonderful thing that she had done for this little girl. And she was basically, I guess you could say, auctioning her or advertising her. And pretty soon after the picture went out, the little girl started having to spend the night at people's houses, people that were real rich and lived on St. Charles Avenue and belonged to all the best carnival crews, came to parties at their house, but they didn't have any children. But still, the little girl had to go stay over there, spend the night sometimes, and let the daddy over there do whatever he wanted. And she couldn't complain, because you had to do what grown-ups told you, because that's just the way life was. There wasn't any such thing as no, or I don't want to, or ooh, that's yucky, that makes me feel bad. So this is what life is pretty much like. And Monster Mom finally gets what she really wants, and that's to be good friends with the most prominent, quote, social society man in the city of New Orleans, because he just happens to be captain of the most exclusive carnival crew, Rex. If anybody's been to Mardi Gras, you know what Rex is. So Monster Mom has now become in good friends with Mr. Fenner, who is this rich society man, and the little girl's starting to spend a lot of time with Mr. Fenner and some of his friends. And pretty soon she starts going to a camp that Mr. Fenner runs all year long across the lake, and it's in Covington, Louisiana, and it's at one of his summer homes. And there's other little girls and boys there, and they do strange things, and men come over, and they have parties at night, and they pass around the little girls and boys just like they were appetizers at a party. And except for the very first Christmas after she got adopted, and when she was 11 years old, she doesn't ever spend Christmas at home again, or her birthday. Both times, she's always over at the camp, and usually Easter, Halloween, and right before school starts in August. And nobody ever asks, why isn't she ever home for Christmas? Where is she? Even her big sister, who's 5 years older than her and is not adopted and doesn't have to go to camp, she never really dares to ask, why isn't my little sister home for Christmas? Why can't she get any Christmas presents? Because she has to be at the camp. But nobody asks, not even her daddy, her adopted daddy. Now she has lots of daddies and uncles. So now the little girl is really being controlled, her mind, her body, everything they think that they have control over. Because basically, the way her life is she does what the grown-ups tell her, and she's a good girl, and it doesn't hurt too much. It might hurt a little, or it might hurt a lot sometimes, but then it's over with. And that's the way life is, until she's in second grade. Oh, and she goes to this exclusive all-girls Catholic school, which she was very lucky to get into. But before that, she went to preschool at Tulane University, which just happens to be one of the most prestigious universities in the South, and where Mr. Fenner, remember Mommy's society friend, he's chairman of the board. And he's also very good friends with Dr. Robert Heath, who is the head of the neuropsychiatric department in Tulane, and who happens to be good friends with a lot of people that work for the government, that work for the president, and for something called the CIA. She has no idea what that means. And by the time she's in second grade, she's told she's being tested. Tested, her personality tested, her memory. She's told she has a very good memory. Well, they didn't even know how good her memory was, because actually, one of her little imaginary friends had a camera in her head, and she took pictures, and she recorded everything that everybody that she had to be with, everybody she had that had to that she had to be nice to, everybody that tested her. Anyhow, she's told that she's being tested to see if she can go away to this camp. And she goes, oh no, camp. But this sounds like a really nice camp, because it's all the way in the mountains, and it's far away from home, away from Monster Mom, away from Mr. Fenner's camp. And she might be going there if she passed her test. And some of the tests are, well, there's doctors that come from all over the country to test her, and they do some pretty horrible things to her, and they want to test her for pain, like I said, memory, personality, and also to see who she seems to get along with the best. And it turns out that she tests that she gets along with older men, daddies, quote, daddies or uncles. That's who she seems to respond to the best. So she's told, well, you've been accepted to this camp. So she goes away the next summer for 3 weeks in August to a place called Deep Creek Lodge in Maryland. And she takes a train with a bunch of strangers that she doesn't know, and there's other children on the train, but she happens to be the youngest one. And so she, they let her sleep in the, I think they called them club cars back then, where they stayed up all night drinking and talking about something called projects, and doctors, and deputy directors, and people like that. And she's supposed to be asleep, but she's really, the little girl inside of her with the camera in her head is taking down everything that she hears. So she gets to this camp, and it really is the nicest 3 weeks of her entire life so far, because nobody really hurts her there. She doesn't get any shots except for antibiotics, she's told, so she doesn't get an infection. She doesn't get any electricity in her head. Nothing that bruises her. And the best part is that she got to pick a daddy to be with for the 3 weeks, and the daddy was going to teach her something very important. And this was for her country, and she was doing the President of the United States a favor and helping to stop communism. That's what this was all about. And so she feels very special, very important. And so she does her best. And she gets to pick this man. They match him together. There's other children there. There's girls even younger than her. Boys. Can't forget the boys. Teenagers. And then a few young women, but mostly children. And they all get paired up with an adult and spend the 3 weeks training. And what training means is that every day, Uncle Otto, that's what this man calls himself, he's a doctor, that's all she knows, and he's from Kansas, but other than that, she doesn't know anything about him, except that he's very nice to her. And she wants to go home with him. She even asks if she can go home with him afterwards. And they let her pick a name, because see, when she goes to Tulane to get all these tests and treatment, she was told that she behaved badly at home because she wet her bed, and she used to cry a lot, and sometimes she touched herself where she wasn't supposed to, and she did these, quote, abnormal things. So her mother had brought her to Tulane. That's how she got to Tulane, or that's how they got her into Tulane, was to say that she had childhood schizophrenia and aberrant behavior, whatever that means. So anyhow, so she's spent 3 weeks, and what's basically, they went swimming, no clothes. They didn't wear clothes hardly at all. She ate every meal with this man. She slept at night with him. And during the day, he taught her. Basically, what he said was how to please daddies. And it was kind of yucky, and she didn't really like it, but at least it didn't hurt. It didn't make her bleed, so that made her happy. And the only bad part was at the end of the 3 weeks when she was told that she passed, that she did a very good job. Oh, and every evening they would watch these movies. And the little girl doesn't like to see herself in movies because she's always without any, doesn't have any clothes on, always has these daddies or uncles that are doing things to her in the movies. Sometimes it was, other times when she had movies taken, there were children, other children, boys, girls, animals, you name it, just about everything. But anyhow, every evening, Uncle Otto and little Ava, she named herself Ava after Ava Gardner, because she loved movie stars. And they would watch these movies and see how well she did. And what she was supposed to do, besides pleasing the daddies, was she was told she had to do something called coercing, which she didn't know what that meant, but it meant make them talk about themselves. Make them tell you about their fancy homes that they live in, or how many children they have, or how much their wives spend too much money on shopping. And sure enough, these different daddies had come in from out of town, you know, when she wasn't with Uncle Otto, they would talk about themselves. And some of them even said, "You're about the same age as my little girl." And years later, when the little girl would start to remember, she would be very sad because she would think, well, those little girls at home, they were probably glad that Daddy was away. But anyhow, so she finishes the 3 weeks, and the last night they throw a party to celebrate that the, quote, project was a success. And it was called something called sensitive research, and it came under something called an MK Ultra, whatever that was. And the last night, a lot of people flew in from out of town on little bitty planes, very rich men, people that worked with the President of the United States, and people in uniforms, and they all got drunk, and once again, the little girl got passed around like she was an hors d'oeuvre. And it was a terrible night, and it lasted forever. And at the end of it, she should have been in the hospital, but she wasn't. She was on the train going back to New Orleans, and she was pretty well, should have been in intensive care, actually. And they sent her home, and she had to go to Tulane Hospital, and she stayed there while she recovered. And then it was over, and she never went back to that camp because she had learned what she was supposed to learn. And this was what she was supposed to do. This was going to be her job, to help her country, of course. You know. So the funny thing was, though, this went on and on for years, and when she would go home from her, quote, treatments that she had to go to at Tulane, and sometimes treatments meant that she took trips to places where there were airplanes and military people in uniforms and had wings on their jackets, and she was told that she had to go to for treatments. The strange thing was that when she would come home, she couldn't remember what happened at the hospital. She knew she went somewhere because she had this thing called schizophrenia, which you don't talk about because we don't want anybody to know that my child sees a psychiatrist, of course. That would be horrible. So it's another big secret that she has to keep. She has a lot of secrets she has to keep. She really doesn't like doing that, but it's part of life. Doesn't every little girl have to keep secrets? Doesn't every little girl have to please daddies and uncles? Doesn't every little girl have monsters in her life? She thought so. And she also thought everybody had imaginary friends inside of them that had different names and looked different. And even had different hair than her. Some were strong. Some were littler than her. She thought everybody had these things. She thought this was the way life was because she never knew any different. And the strange thing was, though, that she never remembered. She could never really remember. And that's because they would put the what they said was electricity in her head. And that hurt. And it always gave her bad headaches. And when she went home, she always got this liquid medicine that her mother would give her to make her sleepy. And so that's how they made her forget. And supposedly, she was supposed to forget forever. But she was told that since doctors were about, they were like next to God to her, she was always supposed to go back to the doctors and tell them if she started having headaches or nightmares. And sometimes she would have nightmares, horrible nightmares. And she would walk in her sleep, and then Monster Mom would call the doctors and say, she's doing something again. I can't control her. I'm going to have to send her back if she doesn't start behaving herself. She stays in a crib until she's like 8 years old, so that try to keep her from wandering around the house at night. And she's still wetting the bed, of course. Uses a bottle sometimes when her mommy wants to make her feel ashamed of herself. When she goes to school, she has to wear little boys' undershirts over her, and she wears this thing called leggings that look like, well, I guess they were like pantyhose back then, but they were for little girls and they were flesh-colored. And what it did was it hid the bruises and the marks, so nobody at school knew that she had bruises. They just knew that she wore these funny clothes and made fun of her. But that was part of life too, being the odd one, being different from other kids. But at least she was special, because that's what the doctors and the men always and the soldiers always told her, that you're special. So life pretty much goes on, only the older she gets, the worse it gets, and the harder it is to please the daddies. And by the time she's 13, her adopted daddy, who never really did anything to stop it, and she's pretty sure didn't really know what was going on, but never really asked, and was scared to death of his own wife, he dies, and she feels very bad about that, and they tell her that it's her fault that he died. It was just another way to control her. I forgot to tell you about the visit that before she went away to camp, that camp in the woods, in the mountains, the man, Mr. Fenner, the chairman of the board of Tulane, who she used to call the Magister. When she went across the lake to the camp, she'd have to call him the Magister because she couldn't call him Mr. Fenner because they all wore masks and costumes and didn't know who each other was, supposedly, and the children weren't supposed to know who they were. But they wore Mardi Gras costumes, and so that wasn't strange because, hey, everybody knows about Mardi Gras. It's just that it didn't seem to be Mardi Gras time, and yet they wore costumes. But anyhow, he had paid a visit to Monster Mom one day, and right in front of the little girl, as if she was just a part of the furniture, he says words like, need to toughen her up, pain, water, punishment, lock her in the closet, dark, need to toughen her up. That's all she remembers. And after that, Monster Mom got pretty bad at home, and when she got punished, she got really punished. And life was pretty bad, but then again, it was pretty good because she didn't have to really go through all of it because she had her imaginary friends to help her, and she got to go away. That's what she called it, going away and hiding in her safe place. And so by the time she was 16, Monster Mom dies, finally. And everybody goes, oh, poor little thing, losing your mother and you're only 16. And she's so happy inside, but she has to cry and look sad and everything. But that still doesn't mean she doesn't have to go for treatments, and still doesn't mean that she doesn't have to go to the hotel rooms that these people from that work for the government, that work for the president, well, they keep these fancy rooms at these two hotels in New Orleans, and she had been trained, remember when she was 9 years old, how to please the daddies, so daddies would come from all over, and she would go in the room and spend the night with them, or spend a couple of hours with them. And she was even showed by the Captain White, who wore a gun and came from California, she was shown how they had two bathrooms in the room. One bathroom was hidden, and it was behind a mirror, and there was a camera behind the mirror, and it was always opposite the bed. And the room didn't look any different from the other rooms, except that it was a fancy room. And so the people from out of town and politicians, just about anybody you could think of, would stay there, and she would have to, you know, stay with them. And she had to do a good job, and she had to get them to talk about themselves, and she always had to make sure that they looked into the mirror. But she was another big secret about the camera. The martini man, that's what she called the man that took the pictures, the movies. He said it was a job, and she was doing it for a country, but she couldn't tell. So she always had to, you know, she had to remember all these things. So it's a good thing she had a good memory. But anyhow, so this goes on until she graduates from high school. And then when she goes to pick her college, she tries to get as far away from New Orleans as she can. She doesn't even know why. She just knows, I got to get out of here. So she goes away, and she goes to college, and it got a lot better. And she only had to see the doctors and the daddies like every now and then. It wasn't as often. And her monster mom wasn't there, so a lot of times she would just run away and hide, take the car and go someplace and go to a friend's house or something and hide out. But she still had to go back, you know, and mainly do her job, being in the movies with the men and getting them to talk about themselves, because it was, quote, ammunition to use against them if they ran out of money. And all she knew was that Tulane needed a lot of money for some reason, and this was how they made sure they kept the money coming, was they had these films that went to somebody in Virginia, and they kept them, and if the people didn't want to give any more money for the, quote, projects, then I guess they would tell them, well, we have this film. Anyhow, so imagine this little girl, 40 years later, walking into this exclusive hotel called the Madison in Washington, D.C., and although she's all grown up now, doesn't have any children because they made sure that she couldn't have kids, so they didn't have to bother with her getting pregnant. She walks in, and she's just one of the crowd, one of the audience, and just a nameless face. But she feels like she looks like that. That's what she feels like. She feels so little and scared and fragile, sort of like scared, like nervous, like I am. So she goes in, but when she leaves the room, her life is never the same again, because she's been asked to give testimony in front of a presidential committee on radiation.